Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Josh Labrusco, who I've known for many years. He is a marketing researcher. He is a political pollster. And he's also the executive vice president of the OSR Group. And he's here to talk about what we all have big questions about, which is, why were the polls so wrong in 2016? I'm sure that's why you're here. It might be useful to find out a little bit about maybe what's happening this time, especially in this next month. It'll be very hard to predict again, given what just happened in Washington. But certainly, what went wrong in 2016 is extremely interesting to all of us. Thanks a lot for coming, Josh, to tell us.
All right. Thank you very much, George, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me. I think this will be a hot topic. I'm sure everybody has pretty strong opinions about at least the political issues, if not the polling issues, and I look forward to hearing your comments and questions. So let me just tell you quickly what I'm doing here. I work in marketing research and polling. So if you can see from the first slide there, we do a lot of things other than public opinion polling. We do new product testing and customer satisfaction and brand strategies. Sometimes we're the people who call you up during dinner and ask you if you're, not just who you're going to vote for, but maybe what products you're using or what products you'd like to use in the future and so on. So that's the kind of thing we do. And some of it's interesting, some of it maybe less interesting than political polling. And I think political polling is something we all like to talk about. So we'll get into that. I do want to let you know that you can get a copy of these slides if you like by sending me an email at jlabrusco@osrgroup.com. I'm going to put that at the end of the presentation as well. So if you're really bored by then, you don't have to write it down. But at least you'll know what's coming. And for our radio audience, that's jlibresco@osrgroup.com. So here's a thought to start for you. In the 1956 presidential election, most of us don't remember that too well, but you probably read about it. Adlai Stevenson was running for the second time against Dwight Eisenhower. And at that point, Eisenhower was the president. And a woman came up to him at one gathering and said, "Well, Governor Stevenson, this time you will surely get the vote of every thinking American." And Stevenson responded, "Well, that's not good enough, madam. I'll need a majority to win." So let's talk about the 2016 election. And you know, whether the pollsters are right or wrong in 2016, you can judge. You may remember how the numbers came out. Trump had 306 electoral votes. Hillary Clinton had 232. And you notice that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 2.8 million votes, which is a lot, but not in exactly the right states. You know how the electoral college system works. Nationally, she won by 2%. And in California, she won 62 to 32. In San Francisco, 84 to 9, just right here in the city. So I would guess probably one or two of you might have wished the election had gone the other way. If that is your wish, we have 835 days until January 20th, 2021. So mark your calendars. So did the pollsters get it right in 2016? Well, let's look at the final pre-election polls. This little blue line I've put in here is to let you know that everybody above that line really did get it right, at least within the statistical margin of error. And I could explain that if anybody's interested. But plus or minus 3%, you remember Hillary won by 2%, right? And all of these major polls, including Fox News and whatever, are within plus or minus 3% of the final total. So for all of those, yes, they were within that percentage for the national polling. Now, if you look at the ones below the line, they aren't even that far off. This LA Times poll, I just want to mention because some people are familiar with that. They did a completely different methodology from everybody else. Everybody else does telephone polling. They actually did an online poll. And for whatever reason, they were more conservative in every single one of their measures. And in this case, they actually had Trump winning. But relative to the national percentages, they were not within the margin of error. So in terms of percentages, on a national basis, the polls did pretty well. But now let's talk about the election forecasts. Here are the major forecasters, with their final pre-election forecasts on the chance that Trump would win. And these are based on not just polls within individual states, but also on demographic trends, on what the economy was doing, on things that those states have done in the past. Various things get baked into different models. And the fact that these predictions are so different from each other tells you that everybody has a very different model. So of the major modelers, 538, which is a wonderful website if you're interested in this stuff, 538.com, they were the closest in the 20. They said there was a 29% chance that Trump would win. You know, not an over 50 chance, but 29% is at least a reasonable possibility. But as you look at the list, my goodness, there were some of these polls that had very small chances that Trump would win, including the Princeton Election Consortium. Some very bright people at Princeton who did all kinds of modeling and said there was only a 1% chance that Trump would win the election. This is based on just a couple of days before the election, so it wasn't a last-minute surprise that they said that. And in fact, if you looked at Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, and some other things as well, Trump himself didn't expect to win. He was already working on his post-election and next gig, but then he became president. He had to do that gig instead. This is the guy from the Princeton Election Consortium, Sam Wan, who's a smart, nice guy, who said that he's so sure he'd win that he'd be right about his prediction that if it didn't work out that way, he'd eat a bug online and everybody could see it. And here he is eating a bug. It's a fried grasshopper, which isn't really that bad, but he kept his word. So let's talk a little bit about how we do political polling, and then let's try to see if we can figure out what the issues were in some of those projections for 2016. So in any poll that you're ever going to do, you have to think about four different things. First and most important is who are you going to interview? Second is how are you going to reach them? Third is what questions should you ask? And the fourth is what do you do with the results? And I think most people, when they think about polling, think about the questions. If anybody in here has ever done a SurveyMonkey poll, you probably work really hard on what questions you want to ask. But you ought to work a lot harder about who you should interview and exactly how you're going to reach them. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Nothing else really matters if you haven't interviewed the right people. I mean, it doesn't help to have 47% believe this, but that was the wrong 47%. I'll show you that in a second. So you want to make sure you've represented the population you're talking to, ideally with a random sample if you can do that. And a random sample is a lot better than a large sample. And let me give you a political example of that. 7-Eleven used to do a wonderful, fun little thing, their coffee cup poll. Anybody familiar with the coffee cup poll that 7-Eleven did? Yeah, it's really interesting. What they did is they said, okay, this is the 2008 poll because there's some great results from that. They said, if you like Obama, take a blue coffee cup. If you like John McCain, take a red coffee cup. And then they counted up the cups, and they had millions of cups in about, I think there are about 35 states around the country that have 7-Elevens. Now, if you think about it, you could probably see there are going to be some issues in doing this. Not everybody in the world goes to a 7-Eleven. You know, there's some problems with this, but it's still very entertaining. So let me just show you the comparison. Just in the state of Texas, in one state only, 7-Eleven had 500,000 coffee cup votes. That's a lot of votes, right? Just one state. And they showed that Obama would get 62% of the vote based on the coffee cups, and McCain would get 38. And partly the reason I picked Texas is because you might not know offhand how the results came out. A random sample poll in Texas with 1,000 interviews, which is a whole lot less than 500,000, predicted that McCain would actually win Texas with 54% of the vote. So who do you think was right? It was the random sample. The random sample, it matched within 1% of the actual result, which was that McCain took 55% in Texas. So getting the right people is more important than getting a very, very large sample. And in fact, I'll tell you the biggest problem with the 7-Eleven coffee cup poll. If you go to 7-Eleven on Monday, you probably also go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you keep going, right? It's about a two-month poll. You'd get 60 votes. That's not exactly how random sampling is supposed to work. So actual numbers are a lot less important than getting a random sample in your polling. Here's another example of what happens if you don't do random sampling. You may remember in the 2016 election that there were a lot of quickie polls right after the three debates between Trump and Clinton. And some of them were even that very night. By the end of the night, there'd be some results that say Hillary Clinton won the debate or Trump won the debate by these percentages. Well, for the third debate, CNN, ORC were actually the only people who did a random sample poll. And I'll show you what they said in a minute. But there were a lot of other polls that were based on call-ins. You know, call into our website, tell us who won. Well, who do you think calls into the website? People who already agree with that website and what it says. So, for example, the CNN ORC poll, which was a random poll, said that Clinton had won that third debate, 52-39. If you remember that debate, that's probably about right. I mean, if you're a real Trump supporter, you thought Trump won. If you're a real Clinton supporter, you thought Clinton won. But if you're kind of in the middle, you would have said, yeah, she did a little better that time. 52-39 kind of has the sort of smell test, I think. But the Drudge Report and Washington Times, for example, which are quite conservative websites, showed that Trump had won overwhelmingly. So I'm not saying they're wrong for what they are, but they're not random samples. They're people volunteering to call in. Some might have called many, many times. Some might have set up their computers to call over and over and over again. That's not random sampling. That's just having fun. Now, let's talk about the interviewing methods. Almost all political polls are done by telephone. I know it's not 21st century, but we do that because we can include cell phones. We can include, we can get much better samples. I'll tell you how we do that. And we do random digit dialing. So even if you have an unlisted phone or if you've just moved in or whatever, we still at least can approach you. Whether you agree to be interviewed is the next problem, but at least we can approach you. Online surveys are done for all kinds of things. A lot of the stuff I started to talk about, customer satisfaction and product development and other things like that. But we recognize that they're not necessarily representative samples. They're people who are willing to sit and do computer polls. And maybe some of you do that as well at home, and that's great. But it's not the same as a statistically representative sample. And there are still some in-person studies done for political polling. That's the way it used to be done back when George Gallup and Lou Harris were doing those things in the 50s and 60s, going door to door with randomly selected households and so on. Quite expensive to do that. Takes a lot of time to do that. It's very rarely done now for political polling, but might be for some big government studies or other things that take months to do. So what do we do to try to get more accurate polls? Well, there are two big things we do. One is called weighting. If you know anything about statistics, you probably have heard the term weighting. And what that means is you take the data you get, you try to adjust it to make it representative. So if, for example, we get a small number of 18 to 29-year-olds and we wish we had more in our random sample, we know from the census that a certain percentage of the people we interview should be 18 to 29, but we don't get enough of them in our calling because they're not home or because they screen their calls or something, so we don't get them. So we put an extra weight on those people. So if we get you and you're 18 to 29, we're going to give you an extra weight in the statistical tabulations that we hope will get us closer. And we might give extra weights to people in certain demographic groups, other demographic groups that are harder to reach, you know, by race or whatever. Older people, we don't have a problem getting you. We might give you a smaller weight. But anyway, that's what we do to try to match the people we interview with what we know are the census results, and in that case, try to get a little closer. The other thing we do is we try really hard to identify likely voters. I'm going to give you some shocking statistics in just a second about percentage of people who vote. But when we come to voting, it kind of doesn't matter whether you like Trump or like Clinton. What matters is, are you actually going to vote? If you don't vote, I don't want you to poll. And as we get near the end, it's a little bit easier because we pass the registration deadlines. So at least we know you're registered. But that's not necessarily a guarantee that you'll vote. Here's what it looked like in 2016, for example. I mean, a big watershed election. You'd think everybody in the world would get out and vote, right? In fact, only 61% of people who are eligible to vote, which means 18 years old, you're not in prison, you know, whatever, 61% voted, 40% didn't vote at all. Now, half of those who didn't vote weren't registered to vote. So as we got near the end, we could have figured that out. But still, half of the rest might have told us they were going to vote or said, yes, I'm likely to vote, but they didn't do it. And by the way, here's the voting percentage in the last off year. This 2018, we call it an off year because there's no president running. In 2014, 36% voted. 63% did not vote nationwide. Can you imagine that? Lots of countries in the world require that you vote or they keep the polls open. In India, they keep the polls open for a whole week. In a lot of countries, in Australia, I think you can get in trouble if you don't vote. But here, you know, we just cross our fingers and hope you're going to show up. And in an off-year election, it doesn't happen that much. So I'm going to give you some more data on that in a second. Let me just say something quickly about questions. We do think hard about the questions in political polling. Because in any survey, every question you ask biases the questions that come after it. It doesn't matter, you know, what your order is, but you have to recognize that every question biases what comes next. So you got to think about that. So what we normally would do is ask general questions first and then get to more specific ones. And we try to be careful not to use loaded words. And if we have scales, we have balanced scales as opposed to, do you think Trump is excellent, good, or something else? You know, we try to balance the scales in a way that makes a more even choice. So, for example, if we had a question about issues and we were asking about your attitudes toward immigration, relations with North Korea, the economy, healthcare costs, which you thought was most important, that's a great question. But we'd ask first, which candidate did you favor? Because if we didn't do that, your thoughts about the issues might influence that candidate question. We don't want you to answer that candidate question after you've just told us how important North Korea is to you. We don't want to bias it. So any political poll you ever see, always ask what we call the horse race question first, who you're likely to vote for. And by the way, early on, we know people may not be decided yet. So first of all, we say, if the election were held today and the candidates were so-and-so, who would you vote for? Because we don't want people to say, well, I don't know what I'm going to do in 2 months. And if you say, gee, I'm not sure, we say, well, to which candidate are you leaning as of today? So at least we have some measure as of that moment that tries to cut down on the not sure, don't know percentages. Okay, so that's kind of the basics of what we do. Let's talk about what went wrong with those 2016 forecasts. And as I said, the national polls weren't bad. The forecasts were just terrible. So first one has to do with turnout. And the most important thing really is figuring out who's going to vote. So let's look at what happened in 2016. This chart shows turnout by race. And what I've circled for you is black voting in 2012 and 16 compared to 2008. And, you know, it was pretty exciting when Barack Obama ran in 2008, first time a black candidate ran. And 2016, we didn't have a black candidate. And you'd think the black community would be loyal to the Democratic Party, would come out again in 2016. They did not. 66% down to 59%. That alone would have turned around several of the key states. If the black community had voted in 2016 as they had in 2012, that would have turned around Pennsylvania, Michigan, maybe Florida. That one factor would have done it. Similarly, if you look at turnout by age, once again, when Barack Obama ran, exciting stuff. A young, dynamic candidate. Let's turn out and vote for the guy. And 2008, 51% did. 2012, it dropped. 2016, stayed lower. If millennials had voted, that 18 to 29 group, as they had in 2008, that alone would have turned the election around. And by the way, if I see there are some people like me who are in the older side, older people are much better at voting than younger people, as you see. And I'll show you some data about that in a second. In fact, here it is. In 2014, last off-year election, look at the percentage of millennials who voted. 20%! 80% did not vote. It's outrageous. So if you have friends, children, grandchildren, whatever, tell them to vote. Goodness gracious. And if they're not voting now, what habits are they getting into to affect them 20 years from now or 30 or 40 years from now? Will their voting percentages come up? Yeah. But will they come up to the level you saw a minute ago for 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds? Probably not. We have to change the culture of voting for younger people. So the first thing is, reason the forecasts were weak is because forecasting likelihood to vote was greatly affected by younger voters and black voters not voting as much as they did. And white voters, if you looked at the chart, voted about the same. There was all this stuff about how all the Trump white voters suddenly came out to vote. Yeah, a little. But it was really that the black voters and the younger voters did not vote. And that was one of the big problems in the turnout projections. So let's talk second about late developments. Now, you may remember this famous picture of Harry Truman. I know we're not old enough to have seen Harry Truman, but Harry Truman in 1948 holding up the headline from the Chicago Tribune saying, Dewey defeats Truman. And of course, Dewey didn't defeat Truman, but the polls predicted that he would because in those days, all the polls were done in person. It took a couple weeks to compile the poll results. And at the very end, Truman was charging and he ended up catching Dewey and winning the election. But the polls didn't show that. So that was another poll disaster. So let's look at late movement this year. You always want to look at this. And in fact, there was a lot of it. These are almost all the really key states. The average of the final polls is shown in that middle column, with Trump slightly ahead in Florida, Clinton a bit ahead in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and by a lot in Wisconsin. And look at the actual vote. Trump won every one of those states. And you remember where the electoral vote was. If you just took even those the three that Clinton was leading and gave her those electoral votes, then she would have won the election. Just take those electoral votes and you've got it to make up the difference, right? So what happened in the last 2 weeks before the election? You probably remember this, right? What happened was FBI Director Comey released his letter talking about emails. Now, we had been talking about emails all through the election, but he brought it back into the news on October 28th. And look what happened to Clinton's lead from October 28th on. It's pretty dramatic. Look at that drop. It was the dominant story for 6 out of 7 mornings from October 29th to November 4th. The dominant story. And even when Comey released a second letter on November 5th saying, we've looked at the emails, everything's fine, that still made emails a story, right? And here's some of the greatest data from the election. This is from the Gallup organization. They did a word cloud for Clinton and a word cloud for Trump. A word cloud means you ask kind of an open-ended question. What comes to mind when you think of Hillary Clinton? What words come to mind? And then I'll show you the Trump one in a second. Well, goodness gracious, look at the word cloud result for Hillary Clinton. You can kind of tell by what things are larger and what things are smaller, which responses came up the most. I mean, Hillary Clinton may have been talking about the economy, may have been talking about race relations, may have been talking about her international experience, but you got to look hard to find that. What was coming up over and over again was email, scandal, lie, health foundation, pneumonia. Now, part of this is because Trump did a lot of talking about that. He spent a lot of time criticizing Hillary in all these various areas, and that kind of stuck. Part of it may have been that Hillary wasn't very good at describing the positive things about her campaign. But the result is that these are the impressions people had of Hillary. By comparison, here's the word cloud for Trump. And you know what? This tracks pretty closely with some of the things he was talking about. Immigration, Mexico, make America great. I mean, some of the stuff about him being a little fast and loose with the truth and so on, that didn't come up as much. Trump, I mean, whatever you think of Trump, you got to agree that he was a pretty good persuader and he focused on his issues over and over and over again. And those were the impressions people got. And if you have a fourth grade education and you focus on three issues, those three issues are the things that come through. So he did much better than Hillary getting people to focus on the right things. So, you know, Hillary said in her book, was the Comey letter responsible for her loss? And, you know, if you look at the data I just showed, you'd have to say, yeah, that was pretty important. But I look at it this way. It's sort of like a basketball team that loses on the last shot. Are they going to go home and say, we lost because somebody made the last shot? No, they're not. They're going to say, why were we only 2 points ahead at the very end? All those things we did for months should have put us ahead by a lot more. So if Hillary hadn't been as close as she was at the end, the Comey thing wouldn't have affected things. Now, I know and you know that there are lots and lots of reasons Hillary lost, but I'm just trying to give you a flavor for why the polls weren't able to pick it up right at the end. I will say, though, that the Comey letters cost her 1% to 3% in key states, and without that Comey stuff, she would have won. So the third thing is, do respondents tell the truth? And this was an issue that at least a lot of people thought about for this campaign. Some of you, if you've lived in California a long time, you may remember the 1982 election when Tom Bradley, who was mayor of Los Angeles at the time, ran for governor against George Duke Majan. And the final poll showed him up by 3%, but in fact, Duke Majan won by 1%, which was troubling for pollsters. Similar kind of thing happened in Virginia at the end of the 80s when Douglas Wilder ran for governor. He actually won, but by a much smaller percentage than anticipated. Of course, we call it the Bradley effect. In Virginia, they call it the Wilder effect. But the idea is, do people lie to pollsters? Do they say, yes, we're going to vote for so-and-so, but really they don't like that black guy and they're not going to admit it, but they're not going to vote for him? Or they, for whatever other reason, they don't tell the truth. And so this is an issue. We did not find this in the two Obama elections, by the way. So at least in terms of race, America seems to have gotten by that. But the issue this time was, are there what people were calling shy Trump voters? People who were going to vote for Trump but felt like they shouldn't admit it because, you know, Trump's a strong personality and some people perhaps don't want to admit that they're going to vote for him. So we in the polling community did a lot of work to try to understand whether there were people like that. And honestly, what we found is that the online polls were 1 to 2% percentage points more pro-Trump than the telephone polls. And the fact that they're anonymous may reflect that issue in some way. But what we found is that in the early primaries, there did seem to be a little bit of effect of people not admitting that they were going to vote for Trump. By the general election, we didn't find any of that. It's always something to look for. It's important to look for situations where someone might not tell the truth, but we didn't really find it, at least not in the general election. So that's 2016. Let's look at 2018. Here's some data on Trump's approval rating going back all the way to inauguration in early 2017, where Trump he was almost at 50% approval when he started out. And then he immediately took a drop because, you know, Trump, some people like him, some people don't. And he dropped into the 30s and has basically been in the 30s and now in the low 40s ever since. He's never quite caught up with the disapprove line, which is the orange one. He's the green line there. This is from 538, by the way. They have lovely charts as well. 538 has a lot of other things, too. One is what they call a generic congressional preference. This one is, if the election were held today and you had a choice between a Democrat and a Republican, who would you pick? And the Democrats always come out ahead there. Part of that's because there are a whole lot more Democrats than there are Republicans in this country. You may know that in terms of registration. In California, for example, only 29% of people who've registered to vote register as Republicans. 44% register as Democrats. The rest don't state a party. And that tends to be a pattern in certainly nationwide, not in every state. But I'll tell you what's interesting about this. Let's talk about the outlook for the House. Okay, first of all, Republicans currently have 235 seats. The Democrats have 193, 7 are vacant. If the Democrats want to take a majority, they're going to need to pick up 27 seats. 38 incumbent Republicans announced their retirements, so that's good for the Democrats. So have 18 Democrats. And historically, when a president has an approval rating of less than 50%, the incumbent party gets crushed, generally losing on average 40 seats. Well, the Democrats need to pick up 27 seats. 40 would certainly do it, right? But here's something to think about. I saw David Gergen speak upstairs here at the end of June, and he said, you know, people underestimate the effects of gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the degree to which design of congressional districts favors one party versus another. The Republicans have been very clever over the last couple of decades about taking state houses, and therefore they've had a lot of influence about the way congressional districts are drawn. And David Gergen says the Democrats need to win by 6% overall just to break even. The percentages I showed you are more like 9. I've also read some people who say the Democrats need to win by more like 8 or 9 or 10% just to break even. So I wouldn't assume that this is going to be easy. The Democrats winning, according to 538, is about a 74% chance of the Democrats taking the House. you know, again, that's not 90%, but it's not 40% either. It looks pretty good for the House. But Nancy Pelosi said at the end of August, a couple of us went to hear her speak. She said, you know, 25,000 votes will probably decide the midterms. So a certain small number of votes in key states are really going to make the difference. So I'd say, yes, the Democrats have an advantage toward taking the House, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to be closer than people think. Now, let's talk about the Senate. You probably, if you watch any of the Kavanaugh hearings, you kind of know what the numbers are in the sentence in the Senate. The Republicans have 51 seats. The Democrats, and I put Democrats in quotes, have 49 because two of them are really independents, but they caucus with the Democrats. So right now, 51-49. And you might think, hey, Democrats only have to make up a seat or two here. This is great. But unfortunately, there's some problems. Of the 34 Senate seats that are up this time, 26 of them are held by Democrats, only 8 by Republicans. That's just the way it fell out. You know what happens with the Senate is it's a 6-year term, and so about a third of the Senate is up for re-election each time. So about 34 seats are going to be up each time. It just happened that an enormous number of the seats this time happened to be held by Democrats. And so the Democrats are defending 26 seats. Republicans are only defending 8 seats. That's very bad for the Democrats. And 5 of the Democratic seats were in states that were won by Trump by 18% or more. There's been a lot of focus on Joe Manchin in West Virginia, for example. Pretty hard to win as a Democrat in West Virginia. Or Heidi Heitkamp, I'm going to get her name slightly wrong, in North Dakota. That state went big for Trump, and she's trying to hold that seat. So not only do the Democrats have a little disadvantage in terms of numbers, but some of these seats are really hard to hold for the Democratic Party. So 538 says there's a 78% chance that the Republicans will hold the Senate. You know, I think the chance of the Democrats holding the Senate is pretty small, but I wanted to give you a real number from people who do statistics.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, as you're looking at this, here are some key Senate races to watch. I put on the top here North Dakota and Arizona because those are states where the current party is in trouble. North Dakota is held by a Democrat, but the polls I've seen show that she's trailing by 7 or 8%. That's, you know, it's not the end of the world, but that's a lot with a month to go. Arizona, this is a seat held by Senator Flake, who's retiring. So it's a Republican seat, and there's a woman running for the Democrats, a woman running for Republicans. Looks pretty close, but right now the Democrats leading. So those are the only two states where it looks like there could be a change, and they kind of balance each other out. Missouri and Nevada, one Democrat, one Republican, are much too close to call right now. And then all these others, yeah, they're close enough to put on the chart, but it doesn't look like there's going to be any change. So for the Democrats to take the Senate, they've got to hold North Dakota, continue to be strong in Arizona, win both of these toss-up seats, and then defend all the Democratic seats in the close ones. It's going to be hard. And by the way, New Jersey isn't even on this list. We've seen some data in the last week that Bob Eugen in New Jersey has been catching up quite a lot to New Jersey senator whose name I'm about to... Menendez. And you might know that Menendez has been a pretty consistent Democratic senator, but he had some legal issues, and Eugen's hitting him pretty hard for that. So that could be another Senate race to watch. So I would say it's going to be a challenge for the Democrats to take the Senate. So let's look at our own Senate race for just a second. Before I put this up, how many could have said that Kevin DeLeon is the person running against Dianne Feinstein? About half of you. That's probably better than I would have expected. So most recent poll shows 40% favor Feinstein, 29% favor DeLeon. And then there's this big box there that says, will not vote for the Senate, don't know. Almost all of those people are will not vote for the Senate. They're not don't know. And the reason is because here in California, we have our top two primary. We've got two Democrats up there. And if you think Dianne Feinstein is liberal, don't vote for Kevin DeLeon. He's more liberal in almost every area. So there are quite a lot of people in California on the Republican side who are saying, there isn't a candidate here for me. What am I supposed to do? And if they came off the Kavanaugh hearings thinking Dianne Feinstein was a problem, I don't want to vote for her, where are they going to go? So you only got 29% of registered voters who are Republicans here in California, but they don't really have a choice because they didn't get one of the top two. So that's where we are in the Senate for California. In the governor's race, we're not very close there either. The most recent poll shows Gavin Newsom at 51%. John Cox, who's a Republican, he made it into the top two at 39. And you can see the don't know box is much smaller here because almost all of those are don't know. These aren't people who don't have a place to go. They have a place to go. They can vote for the Democrat. They can vote for Republican. In terms of all the polls I've seen, Gavin Newsom is much, much better known than John Cox. Cox has to win all the Republicans and turn around a lot of independents as well. And if you've seen any of his ads or listened to his radio ads recently, you notice he doesn't mention Trump, which is very smart. Trump is a good name to mention in some parts of the country, but not in California. And he focuses on economy and some other issues. He doesn't mention immigration, which is not going to play well with independents here in California. So, I mean, I think Cox is doing the right things from his position, but I think it's really hard for a Republican to beat a well-known Democrat. So I think the chance of Gavin Newsom losing is very small. Now, you might have noticed there are 11 propositions on the statewide ballot. Did anybody, you received your California general election ballots? You ready for a quiz on them? It actually says 12 propositions, but number 9 was pulled. Number 9 would have been the cool one about should we split the state into three pieces. I would love to have seen that one campaigned on. That would have been great. But anyway, so there are 11 propositions. And, you know, it's a month to go. Most people haven't really focused on what the propositions say. But I think the ones people are most interested in probably are the gas tax repeal and the one about rent control. And at the moment, they're both trailing pretty significantly. I don't know if you've noticed what happened with Proposition 6, the gas tax thing. You'd think if you want to beat the gas tax, what you do is talk about high taxes. We need to lower taxes here. The people, however, who want to avoid repeal have been really clever. They haven't talked about whether taxes are good or bad. What they've talked about are road repairs and ways to keep our infrastructure strong. So they've said this is sort of the infrastructure bill, and if you vote for this, you're destroying all our infrastructure. They've shifted the conversation brilliantly, I think. So I would guess gas tax repeal is going to lose. The rent control one, I think people don't quite understand, but it would sort of increase the ability to have rent control for residential real estate in certain situations. And, you know, it's early. What tends to happen in California is when people don't understand a proposition, they vote against it, which kind of makes sense. And some of the propositions this year are really complicated. I think a lot of them are going to lose as a result. So what can you do if I'm kind of summarizing? One is you can vote. I would guess most of the people here are going to vote. You showed up here. You're interested in these kinds of issues. But if you know other people, especially younger ones, try to get them into the voting habit. It's really important. And the second thing for my business, if a legitimate political pollster calls, please take a few minutes and tell them what you think. Make them tell you up front how long the interview is. If it's a 25-minute interview, you don't have to do it. But if it's a relatively short interview, you know, if we get your views, we can get much better data. I've got a sheet here of resources you might find interesting that help me, but help others as well. I mentioned 538 quite a few times. They have great data on all kinds of things and good statistical analysis. Real Clear Politics is another one like that. The Roper Center might be one you've never heard of. It's an obscure thing for us marketing research people. They have a great library of political polling questions going back 40 or 50 years. So if you wanted to look at trends in presidential approval or trends toward immigration or something, they have great data, and all the major polling companies supply it to the Roper Center. The Gallup organization has a pretty good database as well. Harris Interactive, where I used to work once upon a time, the Harris poll has some good data. And then the two on the bottom focus on California. PPIC, Public Policy Institute of California, has some new data out within the last couple of weeks about California polling. And then Berkeley IGS, which is run by a guy who used to run the field poll here in California. The field poll's closed, but he's taken over in Berkeley. They came out with data just this week, about 3 days ago, looking at a lot of the close congressional races in Southern California and how many of those might be turned. So
good data available for you if you're interested. Start with 538, but then you can look at all these other things as well. So once again, now that you're through this, if you want to get copies of my slides, you online or by phone or whatever, it's jlabresco@osrgroup.com. Ask me and I'll send it to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Josh Labresco speaking about what pollsters learned in 2016, excuse me, and what that will affect the 2018 election.
I have a question about your methodology. I've participated in any number of those political polls,
yeah,
and they're maddening. Because they ask the same question over and over again in different ways, and they keep asking you whether when they said that, it changes your mind about the person that they're obviously, you know, doing the poll for. Is there some way that you can accelerate the process or get rid of that? It is totally maddening.
Yeah, I can see that that would drive you crazy. And I'm assuming everybody heard that question. If you don't hear one, let me know and I'll repeat it. You're not sure? Oh, you had a question. So there are times when surveys are repetitive. Most of those times are when the people writing the surveys aren't very good at it. There's no particular reason why pollsters have to do what you're talking about. What they may do, however, is ask in a political context, who do you favor in the governor's election? And then they may say, by the way, I don't know if you're aware that John Cox has said this, this, and this. Now that you've heard that, does it make you more interested in him or less interested? And they could say it that way, and it would make it a little more interesting. If they ask you the same question five times in a row, you know, it's not a very well-designed survey. And I think most people in our industry do better, but clearly not all of us. Thanks for your question.
Yes, the chart on the approval rating for Trump versus disapproval was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And the question I have is there a similar chart available that doesn't talk about the person, but talks about the policies of what's happening? And how is that the same or different than this one, if you know?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There are always the major polls have been doing things on to what extent do you approve of the job the president is doing? And that's been going on for 40 or 50 years, whoever the president is. It's the same kind of wording, and it's used as the same wording so that they can compare it from president to president or decade to decade. So it wasn't so much to try to beat on Trump. It was a standard approval question as asked of all presidents. And these numbers, for what it's worth, are way below other presidents. It's just how it is. Trump has a certain core of people who like him, and basically nobody else does. but there also are a lot of questions about specific policies. I'm not showing them today, but there are plenty of questions about how do you feel about the way the economy is going? How do you feel about the way international affairs are going and so on? And, you know, Trump's an interesting fellow in that some of his issues the public likes. The public thinks the economy is doing great, and on paper they're right. And they think that Trump is helping to make the economy do better, and it's hard to argue with that. But they still don't like him as a person. So I think there are certain issues where Trump and his policies might find some friends out there, but they may not like him.
Well, methodology question when you're talking about the random sampling, that most of the political polls I've seen look at a sample size of around 800 to 1,000 voters. If you're slicing that down by age cohort and gender and ethnicity, it means that if you're looking at minority voters under 25, you're actually only polling 30, maybe 50 people. Given the likelihood that people in that age range and group would be using burner cell phones, would be using are not contactable, how do you adjust for the weighting of the four people who actually answer a phone in that group in terms of causing significant distortions in your outcome results?
It's a great question. And it's kind of a couple of questions put together. One has to do with the number of interviews you need to feel like a particular group or subgroup, we might call it, is representative. We usually tell our clients that you want to have no fewer than 100 in a group to have at least a pretty good idea of what that group has to say. If you're cutting it down in pieces so you're down to 30 or 50, the margin of error is pretty high. I could do the math for you, but trust me, it's pretty high. The other issue, though, about waiting is quite challenging. What I was saying about waiting is we try to take the people we did interview and have them represent the ones we didn't get to, right? And so if you are a younger black person living in Iowa or something, we might be really interested in your views, but we didn't get a lot of them. So if we do our weights too precisely, we'll get the wrong result. We might take one or two or five people and blow them up into very large numbers, and that's pretty risky. So most of the time, we don't do the weights that way. And in fact, when we do our weights, we do something called sample balancing. So it's not a strict weighting where we say, we're going to take you and multiply you by three, and we're going to take you and multiply you by one-third. It's more that we take 8 or 10 different demographic factors and try to find a best fit when we put everything together. It's like one of those awful regressions that you had to do in college where there are lots of different variables and you try to draw a line that gives you the best fit. So it's not one variable, it's a lot of other variables that go into it. I'm not saying it's precise, but it's the best we got.
How do I know when I get a call from somebody saying they're from a polling organization that is legitimate and not my neighbor, you know, next door, curious about what I think? How do I know that?
That's a great question. You must have more interesting neighbors than I do. But I will say this. One of the things that drives us crazy in the polling business is when people do things that they say are polls, but are really ways to sell you things. And we have a whole industry, same as everybody has their own industry group, that fights really hard to try to get legitimate polls. You're not allowed to sell people stuff, for example, if those people have a do not call on their phones. I don't know if that works for you. It doesn't work that well for me, but supposedly a do not call stops people from calling. But it doesn't stop polling because polling isn't selling. We're trying to do legitimate calls here. But, you know, you can tell if you get a poll and it says, don't you think that the evil people here, there, and everywhere need to be stopped? I mean, is that a polling question exactly? It's not one I would ask. And even legitimate fun organizations do these things. I happen to know the guy who's head of the ACLU nationally, and he sent out a survey in the mail, except it isn't really a survey. It's kind of a, now that you've been through these questions, don't you think you should send money to the ACLU? So I contacted him and I said, you know, you want to do some surveys? That's great. Let's do some balanced questions, but don't muddy up people's views of surveys by trying to get them to think a particular way on particular issues. So that's a big problem for our industry. If the questions seem biased to you, that's a pretty good hint that they're going to try to ask for a contribution at the end. But you can also ask them, are you a member of the National Council on Public Polls, or do you follow whatever guidelines? And, you know, maybe that'll help. I can't guarantee it'll answer it, but it might help.
Josh, great presentation. Thanks for putting all this together. It raises a number of interesting questions. I like your distinction between the national polling data, which in a close election, the fig leaf of the margin for error accounts for a lot of the discrepancy there, and contrast that to the predictive nature of some of those surveys, including the one from Princeton that predicts that Trump would win the high of 29%. And I also get that national polling data is different from the state-by-state electoral college system that we live in. I guess my question is, have pollsters done themselves a real or perceived disservice to the point where people are not going to take seriously those predictions based on their perception of the past results? For example, you project that 538 is saying that 79% likely that the Republicans will retain the Senate, and it's equally likely that the Democrats will win the House. But that same organization said it was 29% likely that Trump was going to win the national election. So how do we,
overcome that? Criticism. Now, remember, I did say that sometimes things happen at the end and it changes how things go. For example, those data I showed you do not reflect how people feel about the Kavanaugh hearings this week. I think a lot of people who are interested in public policy have strong feelings about that, but the polls don't yet show whether that helps the Democrats or the Republicans or helps people in particular areas. Here in California, for example, with Dianne Feinstein having such a feature role, you might wonder whether people would be more or less likely to support her. So you do have to follow the polls right to the end. But, you know, I think it's a legitimate question. We're doing our best. We're trying to get better with projections and so on. But we clearly didn't do very well in 2016, at least with the projections. I will say this. We talked about this a little bit before I started officially, that polling used to be kind of like the New York Times and the Washington Post and legitimate press in the idea of being an unbiased source of information, and everyone would know that we're doing our best, but they trust us not to be biased in any way. Well, our current president has got us all thinking differently about the press, and I'm afraid he's done the same with polling. He isn't the only one. If a poll tends to support what you think, it's really easy to say that pollster is right. Isn't this wonderful? And if a poll tends not to support what you think, some people shoot the messenger and say, well, those pollsters don't know what they're talking about. I think that also undermines confidence in the polling industry. And it doesn't help anybody. We're just trying to be a legitimate information source. It doesn't help anybody if you beat on us. We need to get better at predicting, but I think we're pretty honest in the way we try to do it. I will say one thing, though, about margins of error that's quite a challenge for pollsters. You know, if you're trying to decide whether to buy a new, whether to produce a new product, and I tell you 45% plus or minus 6% are interested in this product, you know, you have a range of where you're going to be. But if I tell you as a candidate, you know, you have a 48% chance of winning plus or minus 3%, that's pretty precise. But if you add the 3%, you won the election. If you subtract the 3%, you lost the election, and all you care about is winning. So with political stuff, the winning, the losing is more important to people than the margin of error, and it always will be.
You said that 25,000 votes would determine the midterms?
Nancy Pelosi said that.
Isn't that really low, and what is that based on?
What she's saying is that there are going to be a lot of very close districts, and it may be a couple thousand votes in each of 10 or 12 districts will be the key. That was her thinking. You know, to really make a good projection, you'd have to go into all 435 districts, do a random sample poll in each district, and see what the percentages are. Because, you know, with the Senate, only a third are up this year. With the House, everybody's up. So the projections that you see from 538 and others are based on the best polls they have, but with a recognition that they don't have good data for every single district. And some, they just assume that the incumbent's going to win, which often happens in House races. But in others, they're trying to make their best guesses with the data they have. So I think Nancy Pelosi's point is partly made to try to get people energized and not to be overly confident and to realize that it's not in the bag here. We need to work hard. But I think she takes the point correctly that there are going to be a lot of very close House districts, even more than in the Senate side. If you look at something like the polls in Texas for the Senate race, I don't know if you've seen any of the stuff between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke. Fascinating election. You know, we would have said 4 months ago that nobody could touch someone with the recognition that Ted Cruz has. And, you know, even though he's not very popular among his colleagues in the Senate, he did really well running in Texas. But his race is almost to the point of being in trouble, and Beto O'Rourke has raised a lot of money. So I think there are a lot of races that are going to be closer than people think. And I think that's her point. Don't let up. It's going to be closer than you think.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how much do you think that the polling data is actually used in the sort of service of evil and manipulating people last minute, and things like micro-targeting, which, I mean, essentially didn't exist as tools before.
Well, I think any legitimate organization wants to learn from their polls. And even if you're a candidate who wants to know where he or she stands and which issues to focus on, you're going to be much better having the truth. Trump actually had some internal polling data that was pretty strong data from what I've seen that told him where he's strong and where he's weak and which states to concentrate on, and some some people in Cambridge, for example, gave him very good data internally. But as to whether polls themselves can be used for persuasive purposes, that's almost a different issue. And to the extent that people trust polls, polls can be used as a persuasion tool sometimes. We do polls for other purposes that are designed to highlight the importance of a particular issue. For example, we did a study where we interviewed high school students, guidance counselors, and parents all about their interest in the skilled trades. If you've been following over the last 30 years, you probably know that very few people are going into plumbing and carpentry and a lot of skilled trades, and that's a problem in our country, and it's a problem in a lot of areas. And so we were trying to find out about interest in those areas, and then by publishing the results of the survey, we were able to focus some more attention on this issue. We didn't do this for our health. We had a client who was paying for it and wanted people to focus on that issue. So there are some studies that are legitimately done to get people interested in an issue. But, you know, there you saw the, I guess we're still trying to decide to what extent Russia might have influenced our 2016 election. But they didn't do it by, they did it by creating a lot of disinformation and getting people to talk about it. I haven't seen them using polls to do that, but one could conceivably do that, I would think. I don't think it's done very much, but it could be.
If you were to step aside and look at the polling part of your business, what percentage of it is art? And what percentage of it is science?
Oh, what a lovely question. I think the art is more in the question wording, and the science is more in terms of deciding who to interview and how to reach them in a probabilistic way. So the science is kind of a baseline. If you're not doing that right, it doesn't matter what else you do. But asking the right questions is really an art. There's some wonderful books. They go into great detail on how questions should be worded and what dangers you can get into if you don't do that right. And, you know, I think everybody in our business is kind of mixed on the SurveyMonkey phenomenon, the thousands and thousands of studies done by SurveyMonkey and a couple of others. Google has something like that, too. On the one hand, it gets people more interested in the power of surveys and gets more feedback from customers, and those are good things. On the other hand, the quality of the questions that you can write, it's going to be a little different from the quality I can write. I've probably written 5,000 questionnaires, and you've written 2. So I probably know some things about issues one can get into and how to write a better questionnaire. Same as if your business is advertising, it probably drives you crazy when some client comes to you and says, make the ad this way. You say, come on, I've been doing this for 30 years. Don't tell me to do that. And that would be the same if you were a plumber and somebody finally said, why don't you play with that thing under the sink there? I knew that. I'm a plumber, you know. So I guess my point here is that the art is more in the questions. The statistics are more in the survey design and perhaps in the analysis at the end.
That seems like one of the big things that you mentioned about what we learned from 2016 is that if certain groups don't turn out, that the election can go the other way. So I'm wondering if you think that the Kavanaugh hearings were an attempt by both sides to turn out the vote as opposed to, you know, get a Supreme Court nominee through, because it energized both bases and both sides are saying that this is really crucial. You threw in a little bit of drama and political theater and stuff like that. And it was done at the right time to energize the base. Do you think there's any chance that that was an intentional part of trying to get the base out?
I don't. I think it may well get the base out, but I think it was a very strong effort by one side to get a justice through and the other side to keep the justice from getting through. I think that was what they were thinking about. But I do think, a lot of the things the pollsters are looking at, if we remember the things about turnout and trying to figure out who are likely voters, we've been asking a lot more questions about intensity of feeling, not just if the election were held today, who would you vote for, but how strongly do you feel about that person as a way to estimate likelihood to vote. And something like the Kavanaugh hearings might increase intensity. I do think, however, that in Trump's world, there's a crisis every week. I mean, there's something new. And right now, we can't think of anything but Kavanaugh, but in 3 or 4 weeks, you know, there may be 2 major things that happened before then, and we'll be thinking about those. I will say one other thing, though, that's quite interesting. You know, we don't get to vote here for another 4 weeks if we're going to the polls. But if you're voting by mail, you probably have your ballot in a week. you could be sending that in pretty quickly. And once you get your ballot, you could actually go down to City Hall and vote that day. So people vote earlier in a more staggered way. In California, something like two-thirds of all votes, 60-70%, are going to be done by mail. And not all those wait till the end. A lot of them come in earlier. So trying to estimate voting is interesting. And late-breaking events may not have as big an effect.
So the next two episodes of Celebrity President might not have any influence.
Never know.
Okay, great. One more question. Time for one more question.
Do you think that the overwhelming polls that were predicting Hillary's winning affected people not getting out because they thought that it was preordained that she would win? Do you think polling can affect outcome in a negative way like that, where people decide their vote's not in their account?
That's a great question. I don't know that it made a big difference for Hillary, because in terms of who voted and who didn't, the intense Trump people might have voted. The less intense Hillary people might not have voted. But the intense Hillary people still voted. I mean, I think blacks and younger people didn't vote in the ways that they should have, and I showed you those data. But I'll tell you where that's really important. There's been a lot of work done about voting across time zones. And if you remember about 30 years back, as soon as the networks were ready to call an election, they'd call it. And they'd compete with each other to call it. And based on just a few eastern states, you know, with a lot of electoral votes, they might have been able to call the election before polls were closed west of the Mississippi. And that absolutely depressed voting in California and other western states. So it might not have affected the presidential election, but if you were running for governor or Senate in California or Oregon or Washington, you were working with fewer people because the presidential race had already been called. So the networks actually came to an agreement that they're not going to call anything until the polls close on the West Coast. So that's why you won't hear them make a big call on the presidential election until about 11 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock. Now, if you're in Hawaii or Alaska, you're still screwed. But but they'll wait until the West Coast polls close for that very reason.
Not a big enough market for them to worry about. Well, thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.